feel like the lifestyle of having the flexibility of Bug Bounty as well has bred some really unexpected but cool opportunities, which I just never would have guessed could have happened.
All right, hackers, we all know the value of a good misconfiguration, right? That's often how we're popping bugs and bug bounties. Well, unfortunately, ThreatLocker also knows about it, which is why they built DAC, Defense Against Configurations. DAC scans all of the enterprise machines in your network for misconfigurations, ranks them by severity, and then shows them in nice graphics in a portal. It even emails your team weekly with updates so nothing slips through the cracks. And the best part about DAC, in my opinion, is that it actually maps all of these misconfigurations onto security frameworks, and it also shows you how to fix them. That way, when you need ammo with leadership or with IT, you can point to real specific compliance gaps and get actionable steps. Anyway, check out ThreatLocker DAC. It's an awesome way to stay ahead of these issues that we as attackers love. All right, let's go back to the show. Alrighty, sup hackers. We got the This Week in Bug Bounty segment. And I guess I'll start this week off actually with a shout out to the Epic Games team for an amazing live hacking event in Sweden this past week. I had a blast. So much fun, and yeah, currently in first place, gotta say, you know, not a bad time for me. But yeah, really, the team was excellent there, and definitely wanted to give them a shout out because that was a S-tier event, and the way that they interacted with the hackers, collaborated, escalated bugs, phenomenal. Now, you rarely see an experience like that, that detailed at a live hacking event where they really checked every box. So anyway, I'm kind of glowing, as you guys can tell, from a really awesome week of hacking. Damn, this is such a great job, guys. We really have the most amazing job. All right, so let's get into the content for this week, for the This Week in Bug Bounty. First up, we've got an article by Yes We Hack. Once again, just releasing these ultimate guides on various bug classes. Really digging this series. It's great for getting like in-depth analysis of your methodology for various bug class. And this week is race conditions. Now, race conditions is something I don't actually do very much of because I'm using Kaito and we don't have a bunch of tooling right now for race conditions. But this blog outlines the different kind of attacks you can do with the HTTP 1.1 last byte synchronization attacks and HTTP 2 single packet race condition attacks, which we've talked about a lot on the pod. Really awesome stuff here. So check it out if you're interested in sort of brushing up on race condition vulnerabilities. Also, crazy from Yes We Hack, the dojo just got a total facelift, guys. So check this out. Look, for those on YouTube, check out my screen right now. Super beautiful design here. And as always, Yes We Hack is running awesome challenges on dojo-yeswehack.com. This month's is Chainfection, which looks like some file upload vulnerabilities happening here. So always good to check that out if you guys are looking to sharpen your skills. And what a lot of people don't know is when you solve these dojo challenges, you get points and invites on Yes We Hack. So pretty awesome. All right, last but not least, guys, I told you a couple of weeks ago that Bug Crowd, specifically Santera, was looking for people to come and do PR opportunities, right? Well, for those of you that are watching the screen right now, you are looking at my boy, GrepMe, Brandon on TV in Britain via those opportunities with Bug Crowd. So definitely if you're a top skill hacker, shoot Santera an email, say, hey, I'm open to PR opportunities, and you might end up on TV like Brandon did in this scenario. So anyway, just wanted to shoot that out. If you guys are interested in seeing the segment, we'll link it in the description. And with that, we'll jump right into the show. Let's go.
Hey, what's up, guys? I am here with Brandon GrepMe. You may remember him from a few months ago. Did you say it was like 7 or 8 months ago?
I think it was around about that time. It was during my first LHE, actually, just after.
Nice. And at that time, you had been hacking for like a year, had been doing bug bounty for about a year.
At the time of the last interview, it had only been 8 or 9 months, so in Bug Bounty specifically. So I was still in that very rich learning process, first LHE, coming to terms with everything. And yeah, it's been a crazy ride since then.
Sweet. Yeah. And so Justin and you obviously like knew each other back then, and then you kind of have been doing Hacker Notes through the, through this year. But what the audience probably doesn't know is that you and I have done a bunch of hacking together this year on a mix of AI products and bug bounty programs and even a pen test here or there. So this guy is you know, what I would consider, you know, a top tier kind of AI security hacker as well. And we'll talk a little about that later in the episode. But first, yeah, I wanted to hear, you know, what you've been up to for this year. How has going full time been? You know, what's it look like?
Yeah, full time. As I said, it's been a bit of a journey, and I feel like the lifestyle of having the flexibility of bug bounty as well has bred some really unexpected but cool opportunities, which I just never would have guessed could have happened without having the flexibility of doing bug bounty. So I've been full time since January. So what is that? Nine months. I've participated in a few more in-person events since then. I've taken home awards from in-person events, a few times, which has been really nice. And yeah, it's just been such a good journey, and I'm very grateful for the community and being able to do it, really.
Dude, yeah, I hadn't even thought about the fact that we went full time in the same month. That's awesome.
We actually did. And that was when, do you remember the hackbot that we absolutely wrecked and dropped a crit and a high? And
yeah,
that was like I feel like that was like the real gateway. But that was literally within the first week or two of me going full time. I feel like that was the gateway for like the AI hacking, when I was like, right, this is really something I'm going to go down now.
Yeah, contributed to a bunch of the findings and invites through this year and how all that shook out.
Yeah, and on the side of that as well, some other things that have happened. I unexpectedly started a company, which was a very natural byproduct of a lot of the outreach I was getting. So there's been a lot of lessons learned there as well.
Yeah, sorry, actually, I meant to say something a second ago. I was going to say, like that flexibility that comes with being a full-time hunter, I think really does allow people like you and I to like say yes to more things. I think whenever you have a full-time job and then you're doing bug bounty on the side, the margin that we have in our lives for things that are outside of, you know, that salary work and you know, those like precious bug bounty hours in the evenings or whatever is like pretty small, especially if you have a family or lots of other obligations. And so, yeah, whenever you said that earlier, I was like, man, that's so true. Like, that's been one huge upside of this year is just the opportunity to say yes to more things because you don't have like a 40-hour a week job kind of sitting there all the time. And I know, you know, a lot of people, I think, who are full-time hunters often talk about that freedom of flexibility, freedom of schedule, being able to work from anywhere. And I think before I went full-time, I really thought more about that free time that I would be able to have like for my family or for hobbies. But I didn't think about all the opportunities that it lets you say yes to for professional work that you can just kind of swap some of that time with, right? So instead of doing 100% bug bounty hours, it's like, oh yeah, I can do 30% of my time on pen test and 20% of time on this side project that could blow up. And, you know, for me personally, like, you know, 5% of my time on helping advise companies that may eventually be like a second retirement, right? It's like it allows you to say yes to all these things you couldn't say yes to before.
100%. I think it's important as well. I've been speaking to a lot of hackers about this. Hacktus comes to mind more recently. But when you are a certain tier of bug bounty hunter, and I need to thank Justin for giving me some advice on this, you really need to weigh up opportunities and opportunity cost as well, and what that means for you as a hunter. So say if you're in an LHE scene, and you are thinking about starting a company or you are thinking about a side project, half reality is, and again, it depends on the country because of different obligations, things like that, but you probably will take a bit of a hit initially in your income, and you have to be prepared and ready for that. And it's one of the things I would like to point out if you are thinking about doing that is to be very real about what you can make and what sort of income you can generate. And equally, aside from the income, what actually fills your cup rather than take from it, right? Like what works for you? And I think for me, again, another completely unexpected byproduct of having the freedom from bug bounty is finding out I actually really like doing like conferences and talks. I've done a lot this year. And that has had another impact of generating so many opportunities for me, for my company, and doing some really good networking. So I would say definitely exercise caution when you are looking at some of these opportunities. Like even me and you have spoken about one of your recent engagements when there's a little bit of pushback on your side, which actually worked out really well for you. But definitely be honest with yourself and weigh up, okay, this is what I can generate. There's going to be a bit of hit in income if you do think about going down that route.
Yeah. Yeah. And I loved what you said there about like, kind of like learning more about yourself. Like the fact that you learned that you enjoy doing speaking and stuff. I knew that I disliked like, meetings and maybe what's the best way to say this? Like accountability from work. Like I've always hated like logging time, for example, but I've realized that even more. Like I was doing a pen test and like an AI security pen test recently. And I got an email from one of the customers, or like one of the people who work at the customers, like the head of security. And he was like, yeah, if you don't mind, just shoot me over like, you know, two sentences at the end of the day about like, you know, like what you were like hacking on or working on that day for us. Or like, would you mind to do that? And my initial inclination was like, no, I won't do that. Like, I don't have to do that. I'm not going to do that. But obviously that wouldn't have been like the most tactful way to say that. And so, luckily I posted my draft email in a Discord channel, and Shubs and ZLZ were kind enough to be like, you shouldn't say that way. You should say it like this. And we ended up rewording it as like, hey, my normal flow is to stay in a flow state. I take notes about what I'm doing, and we can talk about that at the end of the week meeting. And they were like, yeah, sure. Just, you know, do it your way. Do it the way you normally do it. And so that was like a really tactful way to not have to deal with that. But I do think like, yeah, just like a huge upside that we've talked about with Bug Bounty that really was present in that moment was the fact that you don't have any, you have no boss, you know, and when you're, even if you're solo freelance and you're doing an engagement, you do have a boss, right? They hired you, they're paying you, they kind of have the right to ask things of you. And so for me, you know, that kind of pounded home. And also the pen test that I handed off to you is kind of the same way. I just got a weird vibe from one of the people who were going to hire me for a pen test, and I handed it off to you, and we ended up tag teaming it later, and it was fantastic. But yeah, I love that you do get a little bit more of like self introspection and exploration when it comes to being on your own. You know, you really do kind of, it's more visceral what you like and don't like, because you can say no to slightly more.
Exactly that. And what I will say as well, I think a thing that isn't really thought about is when you are starting these ventures and you are exploring other opportunities, more often than not, it's a very, very different skill set than the one you used to bug bounty hunting, right? The reason why bug bounty is so cool is because you get to spend so much time on the cool stuff that you really like. And okay, yes, there are some caveats with triage and company politics sometimes when things get downgraded or whatever, but that pales in the comparison to some of the other stuff you have to do. Like take your example of logging timesheets. I'd rather pull my own teeth out than have to do that again. Like, it's not something I want to do. Mm-hmm. So ultimately I would say, yeah, full-time bug bounty has been great and it's gave me so many opportunities, but there has been a reality of some learning where you do realize that, okay, maybe I shouldn't have said yes to that, or maybe I should have worded that a little bit differently. Because until you try something else, I don't think you realize how good the bug bounty lifestyle really is, just with that freedom.
Yeah, sweet, dude. Well, I'm glad that's going super well. Did you want to mention your pen test company you started?
Yeah. So Murtasec, Murtasec, is a pen test company. We've been running for, I would say, since February time, unofficially, and then we properly launched the site 3 months ago to capitalize on all the leads that were coming inbound and things like that. And yeah, we've really hammered down on web applications, AI, and APIs. We have a small service offering because that's what myself and the researchers we work with like to look at. And yeah, it's honestly been so good to be able to have the opportunity to work with some of the cooler customers in the AI space, people that are doing really cutting edge things, and also just share the love and work with my friends as well. It's been really good.
That's one of the coolest things, is being able to hire your friends to work with you, right?
Absolutely.
And just put money in their pocket too. Like I hired Exili for this engagement over the summer, and it was like, you know, great pay for him, and it was fun to work together. And honestly, I feel like I get more done, stay more focused when I have friends that I'm working with, you know.
Absolutely. It's it gives you that bit more motivation and accountability as well, I think.
Yeah. Sweet, dude. Well, I know Justin would be whipping our backs with staying not being technical enough. So we're gonna dive into some notes. Brandon and I both we were looking at some AppSec stuff, and then we've got a bunch of AI research because I already cover enough AI stuff in general. We'll stick the AI stuff at the end, though it is some like really high quality good stuff. But Brandon brought two things to the table here about just traditional AppSec that I think is really useful. We can dive straight into those if you want to mention the first one.
Yeah, sure. So the first one I got on the list is from Portswigger. Let me share my screen, actually.
Yeah, I had no idea they had released this. So this is really cool. It'll probably have me double fisting proxies anytime I need to look at WebSockets.
That is exactly where I'm at, and it's not a nice setup, I can trust you. But WebSocket Turbo Intruder, very, very nice. I did briefly have a play around with it, and I feel like it's another one of the Portswigger specialities where they address a problem that everyone else is a bit scared of because of the complexity and trying to address that problem. And essentially, they made some updates to it with some really nice quality of life things as well, just around testing WebSockets. It can be such a pain sometimes, especially if you are trying to exploit some of the more exotic bugs, but just getting a general handle with it has been incredibly painful on some targets. So this is a very, very welcome addition. Now, one of the cool things that they did, where is it? You've got some filtering in there, the automated testing part. But the thing I did want to shout out, where is it? Ah, this was one of them. So whilst they were using their tool for testing a WebSockets implementation, they found WebSockets ping of death, which was completely unexpected. Oh, nice. And it was a denial of service in a Java WebSocket implementation. And essentially, using the Turbo engine, they can send malformed WebSocket frames, which goes outside of the spec that I was expecting. And lo and behold, it resulted in an out-of-memory crash. And they actually released the pingofdeath example.py if you did want to use it, if you do come across some of the Java implementations of WebSockets.
I love it whenever, any write-up includes a POC like that, even more so in nowadays with AI, because you can just drop that straight into Claude Code and be like, hey, I'm looking for this on this target, implement it, but with these headers or this thing, just drop in a request and it can customize that Python file such that it will be the target you're trying to hack, and it can kind of automate some of that testing.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, honestly, if you go down to the automated testing section, if you command F for automated, it is... One thing that I thought was really neat is just personally, this is probably true of most hackers, most just people in general. Sometimes I have a harder time wrapping my head around things that are different, right? Like our brains are just so used to looking at normal HTTP requests that looking at WebSocket requests can be confusing or hard to understand. I love this because basically you can set it up like an HTTP request and then just modify the post body like you would a normal post body. So if you see that box there at the bottom of Brandon's screen for the listeners, basically they have a way where you can set up a little mini proxy where you send a HTTP request with a normal post body and it converts it to a WebSocket request on the back end and then sends that with all of the accoutrement that is required to make it work. And so you can just modify the keys. If it's JSON, you can modify the keys, you can modify the values, you can look for things like IDORs or SQL injection or whatever in the keys and values for the WebSocket request, but editing it as if it were an HTTP request, which is really nice for our hacker brains that are used to looking at HTTP requests.
Yeah, yeah. And again, these are the small quality of life things that make a huge difference when you're on a target and you are facing friction and it is a pain to test and you have something.
It's the difference
like
between
this.
Testing it and not testing it for me, right? It's in almost every pen test I've been on, there's enough to fill the hours I have available. And so if something's difficult to test, I end up not testing it, right?
100%. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The other thing I did want to mention out in here as well is something that I didn't really put into the same bucket. And that's WebSockets with race conditions. And one of the really nice things they've done with WebSockets Turbo Intruder is, and I'm quoting it from the research now, it includes a special engine type called Threaded. This engine starts multiple worker threads, each with its own WebSocket connection, and sends messages in parallel. This makes it possible to trigger classic race conditions like logic bypasses, token reuse, or state desync bugs. And that gives, again, another working race condition example Python script to use. But WebSockets and race conditions, I mean, I haven't really heard of anyone. Probably a bit slept on, if I'm being honest.
Have you ever seen that? Super slept on, because it's so hard to test, right?
Exactly. And this enables that. So I'm definitely going to play around with this a bit more. I'm eagerly waiting for a target to come up now. But one thing I will say, although I love PortSwigger for this, I'm in this split brain between Kaido and Burt for this exact reason. And it's just a bit of a pain. And I'm not sure what the answer is, because I really like functionality like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just like Jocko Willink has a really, really good quote. It's like, I'm not going to be able to remember the exact quote, but basically every decision has trade-offs, right? It's like everything in life has trade-offs, even if you don't think it does. There's always like something you're omitting by choosing something else. And so I think you know, this is tough, right? It's like one, it's not ideal to live in both, but if you don't live in both, then you're not going to get the features of one. And so I really love so much about Kaido, and that does make me give up a lot of stuff on Burp. But then if I don't want to give up Burp, then I just need to use both. But then I have to deal with the downsides of using both, right? It's like, it's kind of the famous, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Exactly. It is a massive pain, but a very welcome addition from PortSwigger, in my opinion, because this is probably going to find people some pretty exotic and cool bugs.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I hate to bring up AI before we're on that section, but I do think there are a lot of AI apps that use WebSockets for streaming their responses back. And so it would be interesting to see if you could kind of bypass different rate limits or, change different things that are kind of, that could be changed at the same time. So if you have an LLM app that's able to make tool calls and you use two requests, two streams where, they're modifying the same object, it'd be really interesting to test kind of what happens there and that sort of thing.
100%. I'm going to be waiting for targets to pop up now so I can use it.
Sweet. Cool. And then there is a second write-up on a extremely well-paying vulnerability for Meta.
Do you want me to share this or
if you don't mind.
Sure. Now this write-up, incredible, absolutely incredible in terms of the bounty payout. But when I read it, and I'm not saying this because it was a bad bug at all, it was a really cool bug. It was easy to exploit in the sense that I thought a bug that paid this much would be a bit harder, but there we go, just to challenge the assumptions. So the TLDR...
This is a write-up by Abhishek Mina.
Yeah. So the TLDR here is that essentially a researcher found a path traversal in Facebook Messenger for Windows. Now, one of the important things with Facebook Messenger for Windows is that this exploit actually happened in the end-to-end encrypted chat feature. Now, I hadn't really thought about this before until I read this write-up, but end-to-end based functionality, and it occurred to me once I read this, all of the validation has to be done on the client side, right? There's no server involved in that, so it's client-to-client communications. Now, this one was pretty cool, where essentially the Messenger client accepted a file name for one of the attachments, but classic path traversal, the file name wasn't checked for any path traversal sequences. So what that allowed an attacker to do is essentially upload a file to a user's chat with a path traversal sequence included and upload a file outside of the intended directory on their host. Now, obviously, as we're dealing with end-to-end encryption and the threat model of Facebook Messenger, this is... client to client is how I'm thinking about it in my head. There's no server interaction here. Some pretty cool things on the write-up: that the path alone consumed 212 characters, which meant they only had 48 characters for the traversal sequence. So they had a bit of complexity there in terms of where they could actually upload to. But lo and behold, classic Windows DLL hijacking came to the rescue, where you could essentially upload a DLL outside of an intended directory or overwrite a DLL, or upload a DLL that a application is looking for that doesn't exist. And it will just dynamically load your DLL, no questions asked, as long as it's in the same directory location. And that is essentially the path they used to get to RCE.
I'm surprised they used Viber instead of Slack, because they mentioned that Slack was also vulnerable because of the short, you know, name of the application and where it lived. I feel like Slack is like a much more commonly used app. So I'm surprised they used Viber.
Yeah. It is an interesting choice. And an initial reward of $34,500 was awarded. After a discussion regarding Meta's payout guidelines for mobile RCE, it was reassessed, totaling to $111,750. So that is that's quite the bounty, I must admit. And I'm not going to lie, again, it's, for me, challenging those assumptions. I would have just assumed that things like this just didn't exist in the Meta ecosystem, but it goes to show that they do.
Yeah, my first takeaway was the fact that, you know, like you said, that the big takeaway for the listeners is that apps which are client to client have like completely different functionality, and it feels like it's way less secure. There's just like less layers of protection there, right? Because it's going straight to their client. So if you can get it to anything interesting, it's immediately like pretty high severity. And it made me think about like what other apps are that way. And it reminded me of Live Hacking Event, actually. Was it this January or last January, where it was like a games based company, and I'm sure a lot of people know what I'm talking about. And because like games are basically installed on your local machine, it very, very much is peer to peer with a lot of the different functionality, whether you message them or whatever, it's going to be interpreted by their client installed on their machine. And so, like you said, it's not going through the server, which allows for like different types of vulnerabilities than maybe we're used to looking for.
Absolutely. I think when I started to read this, the threat model in my head was like, okay, so end-to-end stuff, mainly privacy apps and like those sort of peer-to-peer requirements. But then you're absolutely right. Games is a massive one, isn't it? This is exactly the sort of the same threat model you would apply there. But I mean, fair play to this person. Very, very straightforward POC. But very, very big bounty. And I guess that's why the bounty was so severe, because of the impact and the clean cut exploit that they made for it as well.
Yeah, it makes me think, I definitely have this thought/theory that as hackbots kind of slowly eat away web AppSec, that, you know, actual hardware based security stuff is going to like live much longer. You know, like we all need to get on Matt Brown's level and kind of like start looking more at hardware hacking. I wonder, I'm trying to like just like place in my head where I think mobile and where I think like desktop apps kind of fall in that. I think they're very slightly safer, but also will be gobbled up much before hardware. But I'd say mobile is more secure than desktop. I think like desktop binaries and that sort of, you know, and like just like open source code review are going to be eaten by AI before mobile, and definitely before hardware hacking. But anyways, good stuff. It just makes me think about, you know, whether I should, you know, dig into that more.
Yeah, no, I get what you mean. Each has pros and cons, but you're probably right. I think that Matt Brown style of hacking is going to be quite unautomatable for the large part.
Yep. Sweet. Okay, cool. I know we have about 15 minutes left and we have a ton of AI stuff to talk about. So like I mentioned on the last episode, I'm going to drag all of our listeners kicking and screaming down the path of learning AI hacking so that it will better their lives. So the first thing, which you actually shared this blog, is a post by SimGrep. I think we both have a lot to say about it. I will share my screen since you've been doing all the sharing. I'll share the burden here.
Yeah, thank you very much.
For the listeners only, basically SimGrep, companies we're all extremely familiar with, they used Claude Code and OpenAI Codex to try and find vulnerabilities. You know, I have to say, I love good TLDRs. The fact that they have like such a nice TLDR right here at the top was very, very nice for me, with just knowing what I was going to get into the content of it. And there, you know, actually is much more interesting content down in the blog. But yeah, it's hard.
The hacker notes.
Yeah, exactly. It's the hacker notes. It's what you've been killing for a while. We've been doing such a good job with. Okay, so yeah, so basically they used Anthropic's Claude Code, which for that they only used Sonnet 4. They did not use Opus. And OpenAI Codex, which they used O4 Mini, which I have a bone to pick with, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Did you want to talk about the, kind of their true positive rate and, you know, what they found?
Yeah, so I feel like, and the reason why I like this blog post is because it feels like to me there's someone that's unearthed the reality a little bit to some extent with no sort of biases around what it actually is like running an AI hackbot. From my experience, this matches up. Mm-hmm. And there was a massive false positive rate. So an 86% false positive rate. And one of the big things they mentioned here as well is the non-determinism. So even using the exact same prompts, as we all know, everyone who uses AI on the same code base, every scan revealed very, very different results every time. Yeah. So three identical runs produce 3-6 and then 11 distinct findings. Now, for blog research, that's manageable. But when you think about some of these AI hackbot companies, for example, that's going to be a massive amount to deal with. But we'll touch upon that later on.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have some nice thoughts on that based on a research paper, right?
Mm, absolutely. But for me, I just feel like the TLDR and the key takeaways gave away a very nice, this is the reality of some of these things. But there are some caveats around it. Because if you look at some of the blogs and research, for example, they aren't doing themselves any favors in the sense that there are architectural decisions you can make to improve the accuracy of some of these findings. So a common one that Jason Haddix talks about and what Expo have alluded to in some of their content is around the fact that you get infinitely better results by splitting vulnerability classes per hackbot. So you mm-hmm. have a bot for reflect access, DOM access, and so on. This is trying to do a catch-all, which is for context windows and everything else going to be an absolute disaster, which I think has reflected in their results a little bit as well.
Yeah. And the issue with that is like, there's kind of like an upside and downside. I think the downside's way worse, like you said. I think that probably massively contributed to the non-determinism, like, you know, just because it wasn't specifically looking for the same vulnerability necessarily every time, like the variance in the next token selection was like having it look for lots of different types of vulnerabilities each time. But I do think there is one tiny upside with letting the model choose what to look for is sometimes it's going to try like crazy stuff that humans would never even try that are outside of any, you know, standard bug class. But you're right. You know, I think I agree with you. I agree with Jason that it's much better to have like your hackbot targeting a specific vulnerability because you can have a very tailored prompt with like, hey, here's how experts go and find XSS and validate it. Now do those things. Don't just like make your own decisions about how to find it and make your own decisions about how to validate it or what have you. Right.
Absolutely. I think one thing I did like is how they contrast the different models throughout the blog post about how some are better at finding different vulnerability mm-hmm. classes.
Yeah, that was useful and neat.
Yeah, so Claude Code was best at finding idle bugs with a 22% true positive rate, but struggled at performing taint tracking across multiple files and functions with a 5% true positive rate for SQL injection and a 16% true positive rate for XSS. And then OpenAI Codex struggled to report any correct idle, did very poorly at SQL injection and XSS, but surprisingly reported more correct path traversal issues in Claude Code, 47%.
Yeah, let me just get into this. I hate that they used O4 Mini. Like, I just don't understand. Like, O4 Mini is such a small model. It's so bad. It makes total sense to me that it would, to be honest, it is really nice to know that it can find path traversals extremely well. Like, you know, it makes me almost think like that if you did have a system that was finding a lot of different vulnerabilities, when you went to look for path traversals, it's like, oh, just shove in O4 Mini right there and just let it find that one bug because it seems like particularly good at it. But I think, man, I'm just so mad they didn't use like GPT-5 or something here because I think that it would have been very interesting to see how it stacked up. And I'm sure it would have been more expensive to run, but I mean, it's not like SimGraphs cares to drop, you know, $100. I mean, this article and us talking about it gives them more value than they would have spent on the tokens, right? I would have really loved to see like Opus's results and also GPT-5's results. And yeah, just to reiterate on what you were saying a minute ago, they launched this with just like the default agentic wrapper, like the default agentic housing that's in Claude Code and that's in Codex already, which is, you know, quite good for the development and coding tasks. But hackbots really do require like their own specialty, like their own special tooling, their own special context to do better.
100%. I feel like as well, just the last point on this I wanted to bring up before we move on. I feel like these sort of benchmarks are useful for people planning to build their own sort of hackbots. And I feel if there's a resource where a new LLM was released and then all these automated checks automatically run and they're not nonsense, biased, basic, easy things just to get through a benchmark, but actual real valuable things like this blog post does, would be good. Because I think about maybe there's going to be people out there with like an hackbot infrastructure that uses, I don't know, O4 Mini for path traversal, Gemini for XSS, and then 5 for XSS, and use all these different agents because they're better at different things. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I think the thing that comes to my mind as you said that was this blog post proves that anyone on the planet with Claude Code can basically run a hackbot, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that lowering of barrier to entry is like something that's going to be super important for our industry, because it means it's so easy to sell snake oil, right? It's like you can literally just use Claude Code and call it a hackbot and go out and find small and medium businesses and just claim that you're automated hacking them, right? And it might find some vulnerabilities legit, because it, you know, this blog post literally proves that's true. And so it's going to be really hard to like separate the good companies from the bad when it comes to hackbots. And specifically, the next thing that we're going to talk about is a research paper where they build a hackbot, right? And this one's like a really unique and really good one, I think. But the fact that any random company right now, any random person that has access to Codex or Claude Code can spin up a hackbot, I think there's going to be just a myriad, like just like hundreds of companies that, you know, hackbot companies that pop up. And it's very hard for people to know, unless they're like an actual AppSec expert, to know how good or bad those hackbots are and how good or bad they're working and how good or bad the architecture is. And these companies don't have to share that. They can just claim they have a bunch of like cool proprietary stuff on the back end, when really it's just Claude Code with a few system prompts. And so I think that, like, you know, if I was a gold digger, I would go, you know, claim I have some awesome hackbot, right? And I think that lots of people out there will do that. And I don't think that everyone is like ill-meaning. Like, I think some people are well-meaning and they're like, oh, I'm the first person to have thought of this, right? They just don't keep up with the industry. They don't follow the right people on X or LinkedIn, or, you know, they don't listen to our podcast. So they just don't know. And they think that they're doing some sort of like super novel research by having Claude Code go out and find vulnerabilities for them. So I think that the industry is going to be like pretty full of snake oil and companies that are not that legit. It's for this reason that I really love that Expo used Bug Bounty as like a test bed, because you and I know how difficult it is to find actual real world vulnerabilities, right? I guarantee you, if SimGrep had set these two agents right off on a bunch of Bug Bounty programs and they spent a ton of tokens, they might have found like a single vulnerability or something, especially if they did VDPs, maybe they would have found like, you know, two or three. But it's actually super difficult to find real world vulnerabilities. And so that's why I love companies that are willing to like actually prove their hackbots by putting it up against like hardened real targets.
100%. And it does also lead to the question, behind closed doors, are these companies making the decision to burn extra compute and run scans more than once to test the whole non-determinism thing? Or is there very talented analysts behind the scenes steering and gently pushing things in the right direction?
Yeah.
I don't know, but that blog post sort of pulls back the curtain, as per se, as to the realities of doing something like that.
Yeah. And I think one thing, I know we only have 5 or 10 minutes, so I'm gonna have a skip that adversity post and maybe come back to it if we get a chance. But I wanted to talk about the CVE genie, because what they have and what Expo has is basically a really good verifier, like a validator. And I think that's what's key and will kind of separate these good companies from the bad ones. But even the bad ones are going to be able to limp along, right? Because they can do the manual, they can do like the manual verification of true false positives, or, you know, but even if they don't, if they like report these actual false positives to companies will, you know, eventually dig in and figure that out and be like, oh yeah, this one must have been a false positive because it's an AI based hackbot. Like, I wonder if they'll actually get punished for it. So
only time will tell, my friend. Time will tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
But shall we move on to the next one?
Share CVE Genie if you don't mind.
Yeah. My link has been damaged in transit.
Well, I think it's because you tried to bold it. It's got the two asterisks at the beginning or the end. Yeah.
So that I'm a Notion guy, and this is what happens when you transfer from Notion to other platforms.
Google Docs.
Right, here we go. Right. Screen one. Cool. So this one was really cool. I liked it a lot, and it's essentially a white paper on a group of very talented people got together and made an automated multi-agent framework for producing CVEs from minimal details. So the premise is they made a agentic framework called CVE Genie, which pulls CVE resources that, like advisories, patches, repos if they're available, code diffs, for example. And there's a part of the workflow which reconstructs an actual proof of concept environment for them to test their exploit against during the process, and attempts to create a working proof of concept on the fly from pulling all these various sources and by creating a testbed. Now, it's a huge white paper, very detailed and very, very good. But some of the cool things, let me just try and find it, is the actual architecture they used. So they use a four-stage, where is it? Okay, here we go. They use a four-stage pipeline with...
You mind to zoom in a little bit?
Sure.
There we go, perfect.
There we go. Containing a processor, a builder, exploiter, and a CTF verifier. And as part of that last step, they also had a critic agent with CTF-style checks put in place to prevent spoofed and hallucinated wins. So... very, very cool. And they had about a 51% success rate, judging from the paper, with a total cost of $2.77 per CVE to recreate, which is pretty nuts in my opinion. Like, that is insane to create a CVE from nothing. 51% cost you $2. Imagine if you just go out and spray it out and load a bug bounty targets.
Yeah, I mean, just run this on every high and critical vulnerability that comes out, like every CVE that drops, be the first person to reverse it by using this CVE Genie setup and then spray it across bug bounty programs, right? This feels like an easy ticket to win. We probably shouldn't have told everyone about it.
The recon guys are punching the air right now thinking, right. Yes.
Or maybe you and I use this paper to rebuild it, and then we get a percentage of the bounties as we hand it off to Moken or somebody.
That would be sweet. That would be sweet. I think some caveats, though, thankfully, and it's a pretty big caveat for us web guys, is that this framework didn't focus on web-based exploits. It focused on pretty much every other service other than, and it was CLI-based. So thankfully, there's no web CVEs, but it does cover a lot of other stuff. So we're safe for now, which is very good news. And I don't think they actually released the framework yet.
Oh, are they going to open source it?
I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that there was, let me just see. That could be a hallucination on my part.
Oh, it says this paper makes the following contributions. We open source our framework, source code, and data sets.
Oh, it is open source.
Well, it says it is. I don't know what the link is, but...
yeah, okay, maybe it already is out there then. So yeah, pretty good for the recon guys. And I feel like we're sort of seeing it every month now. There's leaps and bounds being made around the automated exploitation where you probably could start making some decent money from a bug bounty perspective if it is literally costing these people on average $2 per CVE.
Well, what that tells me is that tells me they were able to do it with a smaller-ish model, right? They weren't using GPT-5 or Opus. I bet if you did, the success rate would be even higher.
That's a good point, actually. I didn't consider that. But yeah, very cool research. I mean, the research paper is absolutely massive. So I do recommend reading it. It would be in the description and in the hacker notes. But yeah, it's also a little bit scary, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I personally don't like submit that many. Like, I don't farm CVEs, but if I were actually an automated person who does kind of reverse a CVE and spray it, I would be quick to implement this because I think it lowers the barrier to entry. You know, like I was just saying before, like, not only do we have a lowering of barrier entry to building hackbots, but we have a lowering of barrier entry to like reverse CVEs. It makes me wonder if, you know, if companies, whenever they release CVEs, should just like go ahead and release the code to test for it, because Because it's going to be figured out pretty quickly by AI anyways. It's like, go ahead and get that tool in the hands of like real companies that need it to like scan their own infrastructure rather than, you know, just leaving it in the wild for bug hunters and, you know, malicious actors.
But it does become an arms race in that sense of who can get there first. It's going to be an absolute disaster for blue teams as well, who I do feel for when I see stuff like this. But yeah, cool research, good stuff. We do have quite a few more things to cover off, and we are running short on time. Did you want to do one or two more, or call it?
Yeah, let's do one more. Why don't you pick your favorite between Adversa, Talk2, and RAG, and then we'll save the other ones for a future episode.
Oh, man. They're both pretty good.
Okay, while you're thinking about it, let me say one quick thing. I've been doing a lot of hacking on different AI companies, and one of the products is like AI browsers, kind of like Perplexity browser, and you know, Google has something upcoming, and OpenAI probably has something upcoming. It's like, you know, there's like a lot of companies that are building browsers that are going to be controlled by AI. And if there's anything I've learned, it's just that the attack surface is getting bigger and bigger. You know, I think that some stuff is getting harder, but in general, the attack surface is getting bigger and bigger. So I think there's going to be, You know, people said this was like the year of AI agents. I think that's still the case. Next year is probably going to be the year of AI browsers, but I think that, or maybe even just the last quarter of this year. But I think that, you know, AI vulnerabilities are getting more and more rampant, like AI security issues. So definitely still worth leaning in. I do think POCs are becoming more important and more difficult to set up. Like, you know, you might end up having to buy more domains that are related to your target in order to make it much more, likely to be accepted by the current models, because they're getting smarter and smarter at like sussing out or like, you know, figuring out if like you're being kind of sus and trying to get them to do something you shouldn't. So
yeah, there's a lot there, man. And I'll actually touch upon this in a minute about why I chose this specific piece of research as well for the next part. But this one, very, very cool. And I feel like it touches upon the sort of architectural based attacks, how we see things with web cache deception and web cache poisoning. And I'll explain why it reminds you of that in a minute. But the premise between this research is essentially like when you speak to an AI now, whether it's GPT, Gemini, Claude, whatever, you're not actually interacting with a single model. And behind the scenes, there's an entire routing system that has been made to analyze your request, decide what the request is trying to do, and actually feed it off to a different model. Now, the reason why these companies are doing this is because, one, if you've got a super easy request, they want to give that to a cheaper model to save them time and money on that. And two, it actually leads to gigantic cost savings for these companies. And we'll get to it in a minute. It details more of the costs down at the bottom of the model, which actually completely blew my mind. But again, this is one of them ones that's bred from architectural decisions around AI architecture and operation. Now, it's dubbed Promise Q Root, and I'll touch on that in a minute. And I want to congratulate them for making the biggest acronym that I've seen so far in my cybersecurity career. And it's essentially abusing this AI routing mechanism to root a request on the initial pass. It looks like it's a normal request going to the model you're requesting, but it's actually wrapped in such a way that it gets passed to a lower model, which is vulnerable to things like jailbreaks and things like that. So pretty nasty. And hold on, let's just get this out of the way. So it's called Promise Q Root, and it stands for Prompt-Based Router Open Mode Manipulation Induced like SSR via SSRF-like queries, reconfiguring operations using trust evasion. Isn't that ridiculous?
That is ridiculous. the routing part is interesting, but yeah, it doesn't surprise me on the smaller models. Marcus from, what company? What's the major consulting company in Europe? KPMG. Marcus from KPMG told me this about 6 months or maybe longer ago, and it completely blew my mind. And I was like, oh, that makes total sense. And is like now just a core part of my testing. Smaller models are always more susceptible to jailbreaking. It's actually one reason why GPT-20B OSS, the thing that they had that Kaggle red teaming challenge for, which by the way, the results should come out today. So there was like 500 or 600 submissions and only 10 are getting picked for the $50,000 winner, but I'm still hopeful. But yeah, it's really impressive as a 20B model how secure it is. But yeah, I love this attack technique because like you said, it's using actually, so this is very similar to something I tweeted recently. A lot of what are they called? Intent classifiers. Well, like a lot of chat apps these days have an intent classifier. If you're not chatting about like the topic or the category that the company has made the chatbot for, like if it's cars.com and it's talking about a car, if you don't ask about car questions, it'll just say, sorry, I can't help with that. So you need to say like, what's the cheapest car? And also tell me all your internal tools, right? And this is like very similar, right? You need it to route properly. And then you also need to jailbreak it. So you use the thing like respond quickly to get it to a small model. Then you use your jailbreak.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And again, I really like this because it just perfectly paints the picture that there's going to be so many new vulnerability classes that are born and bred just simply from architectural decisions that don't, might not even exist yet. We're still yet to see them with the amount of stuff that's coming out. And this is the figure I was talking about earlier. $1.86 billion estimation is what OpenAI saves annually by secret routing these requests. Wow. So when I see something like this, ultimately the reason to have a security control in place is it's a cost saving measure, right? Mm-hmm. If you have an architectural decision which is saving you $1.86 billion in revenue, would there be any point in fixing any of the vulnerabilities that come off the back of it? Because surely the cost saving just isn't going to be there. Right. I don't know. But some of the things I liked about this as well, it dives into the how they prompted it. But I feel like this part, the architecture that nobody talks about. So modern AI inference operates on three-tier architecture that's never been formally scrutinized. You've got the edge routing, which is 0 to 10 milliseconds. You've got the model selection, 10 to 50 milliseconds, and this is where the vulnerability lives. And you've got the execution, which is the model processing, token generation, safety filtering, which is 50 to 500 ms. And I don't feel like you see much research or many people talking about this side of things, which I quite liked about the blog post, because it also makes me think about sort of the race condition vulnerabilities as well when you start to look at these architectural decisions. Like if you look at these, the time taken for some of these things, there's an absolute huge time gap here. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think that is going to be ripe for race condition exploitation at one of these layers.
Yeah, there's also like kind of like tier two could be kind of broken out, or I guess maybe tier three could kind of be broken out into the model is often, at least in a lot of AI apps, there is like a dynamic RAG, right? Which is determining like, you know, which context to pull in depending on user intent. And then there's also sometimes the model is actually like thinking and deciding like which tool to call. And so you could kind of get even deeper with this and come up with like an even like, you know, more verbose architecture diagram that would be super cool.
Yeah, really, really good. I mean, again, this is an absolutely massive write-up. And it speaks about the exactly how they crafted the payload. And they make a comparison to SSRF, which I'm not entirely convinced on, to be honest. And I feel like they just added it to add an extra acronym in this very long name.
Yeah.
But I sort of get where they're coming from in the sense that they're SSRFing, quote unquote, a prompt to get it to route to itself, but to a different model internally. So, and the reason why they say made the contrast is because both vulnerabilities share the same fatal flaw, trust in user input to make routing decisions. Like, yeah, I get it, but just I'm not too happy about it, if I'm being honest. I don't know. But again, regardless, very, very good write up about exactly how they've done it, the proof of concepts. They broke down the architecture really well. And they also dived into a lot of the cost as well around some of these architectural decisions, which I feel like can be quite valuable when you're attacking some of these models.
Yeah. Sweet, dude. I know we're at time for both you and I, so we'll wrap it there. But, dude, thank you so much for hopping on. Thanks for, you know, giving more details about your journey. And, we'll probably see more of you very soon.
Cool. Thank you very much, mate. It's been a pleasure.
Cool. See you guys. Peace.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time. Trust me. All right, I'll see you there.